invite you to open your Bible once again to the Old Testament book of Deuteronomy and have your outline handy to follow along. This morning we're going to go back to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 30, back to the end of Moses' life when this singular great leader and lawgiver is issuing a challenge to the nation of Israel and to every nation, including the United States. Last time we began our reading in verse 15, but let's back up to verse 11 and read the section that the Apostle Paul will quote 1,500 years later in the 10th chapter of the book of Romans. Look with me, Deuteronomy chapter 30, beginning in verse 11. "For this commandment which I command you today is not too mysterious for you, nor is it far off. It is not in heaven that you should say, 'Who will ascend into heaven for us and bring it to us, that we may hear and do it?' Nor is it beyond the sea that you should say, 'Who will go over the sea for us and bring it to us, that we may hear it and do it?' But the word is very near you, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may do it." Now Paul will follow this quote in Romans with clear instructions on how a person can be saved. If you will confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. Romans 10:9. So let me ask you, have you confessed with your mouth and believed in your heart? Are you saved this morning? Do you know that for sure? But Paul uses the quote the same way Moses utilized it when he originally spoke the words, and that is to undercut any excuses that a person will set forth to keep from acting on the command. "Well, it's just too hard to understand. It's so mysterious." Moses says in verse 11, no, it is not mysterious. It's very clear and straightforward. "Well, it's just so far away. If only I could climb up to the top of a mountain in Nepal or Tibet and talk to some holy man living there, he could give me the insight I need to hear and obey." Moses says in verse 12, no, it's not to be found on the top of some remote mountain or even hidden away in heaven. It certainly originated in heaven, but God has communicated it to Moses, and now it's written down in the Bible for all of us. "Well, I got across the ocean and study the Eastern religions so I can hear the truth and obey it." Moses says in verse 13, no, you don't have to cross the sea to find the truth. In fact, verse 14, the truth is very near you, right there in your mouth and in your heart, that you may do it. You already know it. It's so obvious, you just have to obey it. And whether we're talking about the truth about that Jesus rose from the dead and is Lord, as Paul states in Romans 10:9, or the truth that the baby in the womb is really a baby and should therefore be protected because of the sanctity of human life. Most people, at least in America, who reject and rebel against those truths know deep down that they are true. Those are not mysterious, vague, unattainable truths. They are obvious, clear, right there in front of us. And so having brushed aside the excuses, Moses gets to the challenge in verse 15. So look there. "See, I've set before you today life and good, death and evil, and that I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways and to keep his commandments, his statutes and his judgments, that you may live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land which you go to possess. But if your heart turns away so that you do not hear and are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I announce to you today that you will surely perish. You shall not prolong your days in the land which you cross over the Jordan to go in and possess. I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that both you and your descendants may live." As I mentioned last week, the decision facing Israel at the end of Moses' life, just as his nation is on the eve of entering the promised land under Joshua, is the decision that ultimately every nation in history has faced and the decision that our beloved nation has faced and is facing. Will we choose life or death? Tragically, 50 years ago, our nation chose death for the most innocent and vulnerable of her citizens, the unborn child in the womb. And that decision made by the Supreme Court in the Roe v. Wade case of 1973 has resulted in the deaths of 65 million babies in the womb, on average, one every 34 seconds today. And when we abandon a biblical sanctity of life ethic and embrace a humanistic quality of life ethic, we develop a callousness and coarseness toward life and suffering. For example, we accept selective abortion to get rid of babies we think might be born with Down syndrome. Did you know the number of children born with Down syndrome in Iceland and Denmark has been more than cut in half over the past 3 years? Is that a good thing? No, because they kill all the babies in the womb that they think might have it. And how about our elected senators and representatives looking the other way when Planned Parenthood violates federal law by selling the body parts of aborted babies? We've grown complacent about infanticide and child abuse. So California, New York have put new laws on the books recently that allow babies to be killed within 1 month after the birth with no criminal investigation allowed. Unthinkable. And we've gotten used to human cloning and embryonic stem cell research that discards fertilized embryos, little tiny human beings in God's image, like they were mere garbage. And why haven't we done more to stop human sex trafficking that often involves children and teenagers? Could we stop it? Of course we could. I can't get into all of that, but why haven't we? Paul warns in Romans 1 that when a nation or culture abandons him, he will eventually abandon them. All humans are without excuse because they have the external witness of creation 24/7, 365 as to God's existence and awesome power, and they have the internal witness of a God-given conscience. But when they reject God and don't even think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, he gives them over to a debased, to a depraved, to a reprobate mind to do what ought not to be done, Romans 1:28. The context of Romans 1 is idolatry and sexual immorality, but then expands into sinners becoming filled with every kind of wickedness and evil, with murder on the list, verse 29. Perhaps the clearest evidence that our culture has been given over to a depraved, reprobate mind is that millions of women callously going against the natural God-given emotion of a mother to love and protect and nourish her baby at all cost, and instead killing it in the womb, the vast majority of the time for the sake of convenience. And then a big swath of society, including most of the leaders of government, business, entertainment, media, and education, approving of, promoting, voting for, and celebrating the murder of these innocent children. What has happened to us? In Ephesians 4, Paul warns the saints of sinners who have so hardened their hearts against God that they have lost all sensitivity. The King James translates that phrase, they are past feeling. That's where we are, dear ones. There's absolutely no denying it. The students of life visit college campuses to try to reach the college students who are the prime targets of Planned Parenthood and other pro-abortion zealots. While on campus, they put up a cemetery of innocence, white crosses somewhere on the lawn to honor and celebrate the unborn babies who've been killed by abortion. Abortion-minded students consistently vandalize, destroy, or mock these crosses, or even steal some to keep as trophies of their abortions of which they claim to be proud. Recently, two college women came up to the display to berate and mock the pro-life workers, and one of them pointed to the three of the crosses and proudly declared, "Those three are mine." She was still in college and already had three abortions. One wonders if 10 or 20 years from now, in a sober moment, she will not feel so proud and giddy about the three precious gifts from God that she callously destroyed. And I realize, my heart goes out to the young women and men who are being duped and lied to. I consider them victims also. But the tragedy doesn't end there. The devaluing of human life at the beginning of life has led to the natural consequence of devaluing life at the end of life. There's been an alarming rate in the rise of euthanasia, so-called mercy killing, as more and more states pass laws to allow doctor-assisted suicide. Countries with socialized medicine have set up death panels to determine which patients are worthy to receive medical treatment, based not upon their value as a human being created in God's image, but upon their age and condition and value to society, whether they could return to being a positive contributor rather than a burden on society. Every nation answers to God. And the issue is God's way or man's way. This is His universe. This is His earth. We're breathing His air. We're standing on His ground. We're eating His food, drinking His water. And we will give an account to Him one day. We've forgotten that. The consequences of the decision are ominous. As Moses makes it clear, life or death, blessing or cursing. Righteousness exalts a nation, said Solomon, but sin is a disgrace, a reproach to any people. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, says the psalmist. There was certainly a time in our history, many decades, maybe a couple of hundred years, when America could honestly say that our God was indeed the Lord revealed in the Scriptures. Thankfully, that's still true for millions of Americans who remained the salt and light of this culture. But it would be a farce to claim such as the official position of our nation, regardless of what is printed on our currency. The wicked will return to Sheol, said David, and all the nations that forget God, Psalm 9:17. Increasingly, our nation is embracing the death culture, and one wonders if we've already passed the point of no return. What is certain is that the only moral force in the nation capable of calling our culture back from the precipice before it's too late is the Church of Jesus Christ. But we've got to wake up, to humble ourselves, to pray and seek His face and repent and turn from our wicked ways. And of course, just at the time when we desperately need the church to turn back to God and the Bible, Satan has infiltrated the evangelical church with woke ideas of so-called social justice that distort or water down clear biblical teachings. We'll talk more about that in upcoming weeks. But if God's people do humble themselves and seek the Lord, then what is our role in promoting a culture of life to replace the death culture that has gripped our country? Last time we looked at the first of three directives and covered about half the material on the front of your outline. Let me just go through it quickly and you can fill in the blanks if you don't have them. We must embrace and teach a biblical worldview. And because so few Americans, only 4%, and even professing Christians, only 9% hold a biblical worldview. That means we've got to know and believe what the Scriptures teach. We've got to read the Bible, find out what it says, what it teaches about the sanctity of human life, creating God's image, about God's involvement in forming life in the womb. Second, embracing a biblical worldview means that we obey and model what the Scriptures command. It's not enough to know it. We've got to obey it, to let people see that we do obey it, that we do take it seriously. That is specifically what the Scriptures command about choosing life rather than death, about rescuing the innocent that are being slaughtered. About 30% of women who have abortions, by their own testimony every year, are professing evangelical Christians. Third, we have to teach and affirm what the Scriptures declare. Teach and affirm what the Scriptures declare. And the most important place, of course, is to start first and foremost in your home. You are to disciple your children, first of all. They are your primary responsibility. Then we go outside our home and faithfully instruct the body of Christ. We start by embracing and teaching a biblical worldview. That's where we left off last time. But here's the second directive. We must know and understand what is happening today. Understand what is happening today. Now, there are three things to remember here. First, we have to know what is going on in the death culture. We've got to be informed. It was theologian Karl Barth who said, the believer must have the Bible in one hand and the daily newspaper in the other. Today, it said of the newspaper, Barth would say, some form of online reliable news source. There's no excuse for ignorance. We can't put our head in the sands. There's too much at stake, like the future of our children and grandchildren. We can't remain disengaged. But if you haven't learned this yet, please realize that don't rely on the mainstream media. Polls and surveys have confirmed recently, in recent years, what most of us have known all along, that the vast majority of the directors, producers, writers, and anchors of mainline media outlets are extremely liberal or even leftist in their perspective on social issues, and thus they are at odds with what the Bible teaches on these pressing moral issues at every point. And that anti-biblical bias comes across in the ways that the news is interpreted and edited and presented. So you're not going to hear the truth most of the time on those issues or any other issues for that matter. One of the reasons the mainstream media hated President Trump is because he consistently and publicly called them out for their lies that he called fake news. More and more Americans are becoming aware of this bias so that their confidence in the mainstream media is at an all-time low, as it should be. So you have to learn about and utilize reliable Christian news sources. There didn't used to be that many. There are many more today. You won't hear the truth from the mainline media, so you have to know which Christian news sources are reliable. They are not all reliable just because they claim to be Christian. Thank the Lord, there are many today that God has raised up so that we don't have to be left out in the dark. We can't be at all these places. We can't be on the steps of the Supreme Court all the time. We can't be at the courthouse or the state house or the White House. We have to make a living. We have responsibilities. But thank the Lord, He's got some people there on the front lines that are looking out for us and are keeping their eye on Washington and state governments, what's happening in Hollywood and on college campuses, and can alert us to the issue on a daily and sometimes hourly basis through social media. I've listed some of them here for you, especially in light of our topic on the sanctity of life. There are many more, but these are all I can fit on your outline, and please, so just jot down a few notes. We'll go through these quickly. National Right to Life Committee, founded in 1967, it's the oldest and largest national pro-life organization in the United States, with affiliates in all 50 states, over 3,000 local chapters nationwide. It works through legislation and education to oppose induced abortion, infanticide, euthanasia, and assisted suicide. Their mission is to protect and defend the most fundamental right of humankind, the right to life of every innocent human being from the beginning of life to natural death. Carol Tobias is the current president. You can get their monthly newsletter. It's free. It's very informative. Go to the website, nrlc.org. You'll find many helpful articles, keep you up to date on what is happening. I just checked it out this week. There's some great articles there right now. They're worthy of your support. Focus on the Family, a great organization founded by James Dobson in 1977. Jim Daly is the current president. It's helped millions of moms and dads, including this dad, be a better parent. And it also keeps us informed of legislation and other political issues that come up in Washington or individual states that have a direct impact upon the family and the unborn. Their ongoing program to place ultrasound machines, Option Ultrasound, in crisis pregnancy centers. They've given over $10 million to that since 2004, and they've saved 475,000 babies. Get their monthly newsletter, subscribe to Citizen Magazine. It is an excellent source of information. Go to their website, family.org. Decision Magazine, highly recommend this monthly publication of the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. It's $15 a year, very informative. It'll keep you up to date on many important issues. I wish every Christian in America got this magazine in their mailbox or their digital version every month. American Center for Law and Justice. Jay Sekulow heads up this organization, was founded to counter the ACLU and promote religious freedom. They do much to promote the culture of life. You listen to their program 12 noon every weekday on 105.5, the Truth Network FM, their website, acLJ.org. Family Research Council, this was started by Focus on the Family. Tony Perkins, former congressman from Louisiana, heads up this organization. Their website, frc.org. You can get daily email updates if you wish. D. James Kennedy Ministries, founded by the late Dr. James Kennedy, who was such a champion for the cause of life. Their monthly newsletter is very informative. Students for Life of America, also known as simply Students for Life, founded in 1988, still headed up by Kristen Hawkins. It's headquartered in Fredericksburg, Virginia, is the nation's largest pro-life youth organization, the only national pro-life organization dedicated to training and equipping high school, college, medical, and law school students. Currently has more than 2,000 student groups across the nation, serves more than 1,240 groups on college, university, middle, and high school, medical, and law school campuses in all 50 states. This group is on the front lines of the abortion battle. They're the ones I talked about, put up the crosses a while ago. as more conversations with those who are most targeted by the abortion industry every day, week, year, than any other pro-life outreach in the world mobilizes the pro-life generation to confront abortion at the local, state, and national levels on a daily basis. Every week, their entities reach more than 2 million people across social media platforms to have nearly 200,000 digital conversations with the most engaged pro-life online audience in the world. They deserve your support. I'm so thankful that they're there. What they're doing, courageous. They get spit on. They get beat up sometimes. They get blasphemed, the name-calling. They're sometimes threatened. But they're right there on the front lines. I thank the Lord for them. Concerned Women for America, founded in 1979 by Tim and Beverly LaHaye, both now in heaven. It's a socially conservative Christian nonprofit women's activist group of the United States, headquartered in Washington, D.C. Sanctity of life is one of the seven core issues that they focus upon. Penny Young Nance is their current president, CEO, their website, concernedwomen.org. March for Life, the annual pro-life rally protesting abortion held in Washington, D.C., on or near the anniversary of the Supreme Court Roe v. Wade decision. The march is organized by the March for Life Education Defense Fund as a peaceful demonstration to share the truth concerning the greatest human rights violation of our time, legalized abortion on demand. This year's march, the 50th anniversary, took place 9 days ago on Friday, January 20th. The theme this year was Next Steps, marching forward into a post-Roe America. Every year, as this year, it's the largest pro-life rally in the world, hundreds of thousands in attendance. I haven't been able yet to find a good estimate of just how many hundreds of thousands were there. Speakers this year, Mississippi Attorney General Lynn Fitch, who won the Dobbs Supreme Court case that overturned Roe v. Wade, Franklin Graham, president of Samaritan's Purse, Sister Mary Casey of the Sisters of Life, Dr. Christina Francis, CEO-elect of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, Gina Tomes, Program Director of the Bethlehem House Maternity Home, Jonathan Rumi, best known for his award-winning role as Jesus in the Chosen series, and Coach Tony Dungy, New York Times best-selling author and Pro Football Hall of Famer. Legislative speakers included House Majority Speaker Steve Scalise, Congressman Christopher Smith, who's the co-chair of the Congressional Pro-Life Caucus, and a rarity, Connecticut State Representative Trinae McGee, a rare pro-life Democrat. I have a lot of great quotes from people who were at the march, but I'll leave those out for time's sake. These are just a few of the organizations and news outlets. Phyllis Schlafly's Eagle Forum is another. American Family Association, headed by Donna Wildman, is another. Alan Sears, Alliance Defending Freedom, is an important Christian legal group that helps promote the sanctity of life, providing free legal counsel for those that are facing lawsuits for their stand. Matt Staver's Liberty Counsel is another. Christian Coalition helps believers with voter guides to alert us to where candidates stand on key moral issues. And then local organizations like Pregnancy Support Services, another good source of information. So also is the North Carolina Right to Life headquarters. And a very important one on the state level is the North Carolina Values Coalition, founded in 2011. Tammy Fitzgerald is the executive director. Some of you may listen to the Steve Noble radio show on the Truth Network at 4 each afternoon. That's a good source. And there are many, many, many others. So there's no excuse for not knowing. Well, I just didn't know about it. Why? Is that what you're going to tell the Lord? Well, I didn't know, Lord. Why didn't you know? Often the national mainline media keeps these issues hidden from the general public until it's too late for people to contact their elected officials. But Christian outlets keep us informed. And that's why it's so important to know where they can be found on the radio or the internet or be on their mailing list. If you have questions afterwards, ask me. That's why the death culture has tried in the past to push the so-called fairness doctrine that would effectively shut down Christian talk radio. They don't want us to misinform the public. Right. We've got to stay informed so that we know how to pray, so that we know when to write our congressman. Well, I stay away from politics. We're not talking about politics. We're talking about moral issues, babies being murdered. Okay? We need to know what positions candidates for office hold on these moral issues. Maybe you have a passion for this kind of ministry. You say, Dale, sounds like you've got a passion. I do. But I got a lot of other things to do. So maybe you'd like to serve the body of this church body by keeping us informed and updated about these important issues that come up. I have prayed that God would put his hand on one of you. Say, you know, I would really like to do that. So pray about it. We need to be informed about where we are now and then understand what has brought us to this point. First, evolution. Evolution is the philosophical foundation of the death culture. No question about it. Notice I didn't say the scientific foundation, because evolution is not good science. Evolutionism is a philosophy based upon the positions of naturalism and materialism. It is a theory espoused by faith, not scientific fact, and it cannot be reconciled with biblical teaching, regardless of what theistic evolutionists say. Something has to be twisted, and guess what it is? It's always the Bible and not evolutionary theory. That's why the death culture is so opposed to biblical creationism being taught side by side in public school science classes as a viable theory of the origin of the universe and life. There are thousands of creationist scientists with PhDs from top universities who have disproved all of the tenets of Darwinism. There are many more scientists and educators like Michael Behe, Michael Denton, William Dembski, Philip Johnson, who are not evangelical Christians, I wish they were, but who have rejected evolutionism based upon the evidence and instead promote what they call intelligent design position. But the death culture is horrified of public school children being exposed to the evidence for creation because they know that all of the hard, irrefutable evidence is on our side. They have such a stranglehold on public education in America that they've succeeded to this point in maintaining an evolutionary monopoly on what children are taught in public school. We need to pray earnestly that that situation will change. Well, if evolution is the philosophical worldview of the death culture that's embraced with religious fervor, and it is, then secular humanism is the religion of the culture of death. Even federal courts and the Supreme Court in several cases have acknowledged that secular humanism is a religion, and it is the prevailing religion of the death culture. It's not a theistic religion, but it is a religion, a humanistic religion. We as Christians begin with the statement, God is. And everything else in life flows from that fact. First verse of the Bible, in the beginning, God. Doesn't start out by, well, we want to prove to you that God exists. It just declares, God created the heavens and the earth. He created the universe. He exists. He's revealed himself to us in his word, the Bible, and we are all accountable to him. We can deny him. We can act as though he doesn't exist, but as Luther put it, one moment after we die, guess who we have to face? The secular humanist begins with the statement, God isn't. And everything else flows from that. To them, mankind is the measure of all things, and all their decisions are based upon what they think man should do, with no regard at all for what God has said. As long as it's between two consenting adults, that's all that matters. After all, who cares what God thinks if he is there? That's their view. In effect, they worship at the shrine of human opinion. They dominate the popular culture of our day because, to their credit, they realized early on in the battle for the minds of the public that public education and popular entertainment are the arenas of transformation. And they have done a great job. You know, you wouldn't know it right now, but some of us remember how drought-stricken our area was about 15 years ago. Water became a very precious commodity to us, something we've most often taken for granted in the past. But suppose a city like Durham or Raleigh has one water supply and a person with evil intent was able to pour poison into the water supply day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, decade after decade. If that poison wasn't filtered out, but allowed to contaminate the water more and more every day, don't you think the people who drink that water will eventually be affected? Of course they will. Many will get sick, many more will die. And that approach, pouring poisonous ideas into the minds of children, very vulnerable children from kindergarten up, is what has changed the thinking of our culture in such a dramatic way over the past century. For example, John Dewey, a liberal, agnostic, radical, socialist, and secular humanist who embraced Darwin's theory of natural selection, realized in the latter part of the 19th century that the way to revolutionize the culture was to capture the minds of the children, of course. And though he died of pneumonia in 1952 at the age of 92, he has had a profound impact upon the public school system of the United States during the 20th and into the 21st century. And as far as I'm concerned, that impact has been overwhelmingly negative. The words authority, discipline, deferred gratification, tradition, hierarchy, and order were not a part of his vocabulary. And he hated the McGuffey readers, designed to instill character, patriotism, and love of God. About 120 million copies of these, which were strongly Christian, at least in the early editions, were used from 1836 to at least 1960 to teach almost all public school children how to read in America. And since 1961, they've continued to sell at a rate of some 30,000 copies a year, used by a lot of private schools and homeschooling families. Dewey hated them. He taught at the University of Chicago for 10 years and founded his experimental school. Some parents in Chicago claimed after a morning of chaotic play in the Dewey School, they had to teach their children how to read and write. President Eisenhower blamed America's educational failings even in the 1950s on, quote, John Dewey's teachings. And Dewey's influence to this day goes far beyond the borders of the United States, to Japan, China, Turkey, Mexico, South Africa, and others. Today, in 11 countries ranging from Italy to Argentina, there are Dewey centers that look to humanize education and study other aspects of his philosophy. In fact, Peter Gibbons, in an article in Humanist Magazine in 2019, said of Dewey that his ideas altered the education of children worldwide. And his like-minded progressives have also captured the popular entertainment outlets so that most of the movies on the big screen, most of the TV programs on the small screen, most of the magazines published every month, most of the music played on the radio and through headphones and on stuff on the internet are directly at odds with biblical values of life, marriage, sexuality, family, and any other societal issues. This is not neutral, dear ones. This didn't just happen by accident. The cultural shift away from the biblical foundations of our country during my lifetime has been cataclysmic. So the beliefs and behavior that were shocking and disgusting quite recently to the vast majority of Americans, not just Christians, are now not only accepted, but celebrated. And you'd better go along with it, or you're in trouble. Another fact to understand is that the judicial system has been the activist vehicle of change. The judicial system has been the mechanism by which the death culture has tightened its iron grip on our society. The deathmongers realized early on, even with the cultural shift, that there's been enough of a Christian memory in this country to hinder them from fully advancing their cause through the elected branches of government, at least on the federal level. Presidents and congressmen and senators are accountable to the people. They can be voted out of office. All it takes is an informed voting public to stop the death culture in its tracks. But federal judges, Supreme Court justices, are appointed and serve for life. And they make decisions that impact the lives and deaths of millions of people for generations, like the infamous Roe v. Wade decision and the Doe v. Bolton cases in 1973, the Obergefell v. Hodges case in 2015 that basically legalized so-called same-sex marriage. So the death culture has cleverly advanced its agenda through the courts, and they've been alarmingly successful, from kicking prayer and the Ten Commandments and the teaching of biblical creation out of public schools, to legalizing abortion on demand and euthanasia, to changing the definition of marriage that went back to the Garden of Eden, and as we'll see in upcoming weeks, some horrible things that they're teaching in public schools today. It took a long time for the pro-life community to catch on to what was happening. Christians in totalitarian countries like China, where abortion has been mandated for decades to adhere to a one-child-only policy, don't have the opportunity to affect political change that promotes life. But thank the Lord that's not true in this country. And at least some American Christians are finally beginning to understand how important it is to have a pro-life president in the White House and pro-life senators